This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Convicted murderer Barton McNeil is trying to pin the killing of his daughter Christina on his ex, Misook Nolan. Nolan has written a letter denying it and saying police looked at receipts and witnesses to her alibi at the time.
She seems pretty firm in stating that she didn't do it. She's definitely pinning it on Bart, saying, you know, that this is an attempt by him to draw attention away.
Illinois Wesleyan University social psychologist and true crime buff Amanda Vickery joins journalists Scott Reeder and Willis Kern on the next edition of Suspect Convictions. Plus, we recap more of the top accessed stories of 2017 on GLT. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We begin this December 29th edition of Sound Ideas with an episode of the ongoing podcast Suspect Convictions, delving into the case of convicted murderer Barton McNeil. McNeil is trying to divert suspicion onto his ex, Misook Nolan, herself serving hard prison time for killing her mother-in-law. Nolan has sent journalist Scott Reeder a letter denying the allegation and saying Bloomington police looked at her alibi, contacted witnesses, used receipts to prove she was nowhere near the scene of the three-year-old Christina McNeil's murder during the time of the killing. Suspect Convictions hosts Scott Reeder and Willis Kern talk about how the Barton McNeil murder case is unfolding with Illinois Wesleyan social psychologist and true crime buff Amanda Vickery.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape, and when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911,
what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. Three-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Misook to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reeder Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We've been investigating the mysterious death of three-year-old Christina McNeil, who was found not breathing by her father in their Bloomington, Illinois apartment on June 16, 1998. Barton McNeil was convicted in connection with his daughter's death, though he has alleged since the day after the incident it was his girlfriend, Misook Nolan, who was responsible for Christina's death. Years later, Misook was convicted herself of murdering her mother-in-law. Today, during Suspect Conviction, Scott, we hear from a professor and true crime buff.
Yes, we have a very distinguished professor. Her name is Amanda Vickery. She teaches psychology at Illinois Wesleyan University, right here in Bloomington, Illinois, where the murder took place. And not only that, Amanda is a diehard true crime buff, but she appeared on a true crime show this past week, Married with Secrets.
He did engage the victim in conversation about him watching her.
He knew she had a roommate, and he had been planning to do the same thing to her. This is a very dangerous man who may strike again.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this, Amanda?
It was pretty exciting, given that, you know, I watch these shows for fun, and then to be on one was just sort of out of this world. So they did a show on our very own local Bloomington cop / serial rapist, Jeff Pilo. So he was a Bloomington police officer who was convicted of assaulting several women. It's a pretty crazy story. And so they came and filmed around Bloomington, and I was their local crime expert.
We can talk a little bit about the show. Some of the sexual assault survivors appeared on the show and talked about it. There was once a time when we didn't talk about those things, and it was there was a culture silence around this. Has things changed a little bit?
I think so, and that was something that I've heard other people and experts mention about this case, actually, that the survivors were really outspoken and willing to come forward, and they wanted to testify. And I've seen other clips of them that weren't shown on this particular program where they're there at the courthouse and they're angry and they, you know, just want him to go to jail. And so one of them said one time in a program, I remember hearing something like, you know, he picked the wrong women. And he really did, because they were not hesitant about going after him and being forthcoming about what he did. It was really impressive.
You know, I'm a survivor.
Yes, I saw that online recently.
Well, I write a newspaper column. It's been, of course, as our listeners probably know, I mean, I've been a newspaper reporter and editor for almost 30 years, and I wrote a column about being attacked when I was 12 years old by a man. It was a very difficult column to write about. And
is that something that you have never written about before?
No. In fact, it's something I really have never really talked about outside of a few very intimate settings, like with a counselor at one time and with my wife. I mean, I've been such a deep, dark secret. When I got attacked, it was actually, I grew up on a farm and I was baling hay, and a man grabbed me and threw me on the ground and started kissing me and groping me.
Oh my
and
gosh.
I broke away and ran, and I told my mother, and her response was, take a shower and we'll never speak of this again.
Mm-hmm.
And 40 years have passed, but I know the scars that are there. I mean, you know, like 10 years later, I would wake up in my college dorm room just terrified because I was reliving this in a dream. And I think a lot of people don't understand when you're the victim of a crime like this, it stays with you a long, long time. I thought it was really cool that these women felt empowered to come forward and talk about what happened to them. And I think it's, you know, one of the things that's, as a journalist, I think is really important is, for a long time, there's so much shame surrounding being a survivor. And there's nothing to really be ashamed of. You didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But for some reason, newspapers and other places have treated it like it's something shameful. I think it's really encouraging now that women feel, and some men, you know, obviously, feel comfortable stepping forward and talking about what happened to them.
And saying, go ahead and print my name. You know, I have nothing to be ashamed of. I don't need to be anonymous.
Exactly. So let's talk about the Masuk and Barton McNeil and Christina McNeil in this case. I'm told you're one of our avid listeners. So give me your impressions of the case so far.
It's a complicated one. On the surface, if you look at this case, when I was trying to tell some of my family members over Christmas that I was, you know, going to be talking to you about it, I'm trying to explain it to them, and they're just like, what? I can't even follow this. So you have this woman who brutally murdered her mother-in-law, likely strangled her to death, we think, and, you know, hangs out with her body for a while until she has someone from church unknowingly help her move and bury it. And then you find out that 10 years or so ago before that, a man goes into his daughter's room and finds her dead and tries to tell the police that his crazy ex-girlfriend did it. And no one believes him and he's in jail. And then you find out that the crazy ex-girlfriend is the woman who went on to murder her mother-in-law. I mean, it's like one of those made-for-TV movies that you think can't really be based on true events, or they're exaggerating something, but this really is what happened. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
There's people out there who seem on the surface very normal, and then you find out there's these deep, dark secrets out there, and it's like, ooh, wow. I did a story on death row. When there was a death row here in Illinois, I went up to Pontiac Penitentiary, and I was interviewing a death row inmate, and I'm in the death row visiting room, and I'm looking around at the other inmates, And it's like, these guys look so ordinary.
Oh, yeah.
It's the banality of it. I mean, they could be the customers at the diner I have breakfast at every morning. I mean, there's no horns growing out of the back of their head, and all, but all of them had committed horrible, horrible murders. Murders so violent and so depraved that a jury decided to put them on death row.
She was married a couple times, right?
Yeah, she
had a couple kids.
Yes.
Apparently, there were people out there who thought that she was pretty normal. And then for this to be a woman is highly unusual. I mean, there certainly are women killers out there. But I feel like most of the time, it's maybe a one-time situation. You know, they kill their husband or something like that. Whereas in this case, well, she's only been convicted of one murder, but, you know, suspected perhaps, and at least one other. And so that makes it even more unusual.
You specialize in something called attachment theory. I would like you to explain that to us and give us your impression on how this might have affected Masuk.
Well, the basic idea of attachment theory is that your interaction at a very young age, basically from birth, the first couple of years of your life, can really set the stage for how you interact with not only, you know, your parents, but other people throughout the rest of your life. So, for example, if you grew up with a mother who was caring, who was attentive to your needs, who came to you quickly when you were crying as a child, you sort of develop this secure attachment orientation, this idea that you're going to be able to trust and rely upon others, that other people are trustworthy, and people tend to have then more secure, satisfying romantic relationships as adults, better relationships with their parents, their friends, their children. Whereas people who grow up with caregivers, usually the mother, who is more avoidant, who is involved, who doesn't speak to the child's needs, or who is more inconsistent, maybe the person, you know, is on drugs or alcohol or something like that, then the child has a greater tendency to grow up being more anxious or avoidant themselves, not trusting others, kind of seeking out more dysfunctional relationships. And this isn't a 100% guarantee. It's not as if you grow up in a rough household that you're guaranteed to, you know, struggle with attachment throughout the rest of your life. But there have been studies that have followed many people for many years and found that there does seem to be a strong link between how you're treated those first couple of years of life and how you end up as an adult relating to others. We don't know a lot about this book. Early life, right?
Well, we know that her mom died at a very young age when Masuk is very young. We know that at least the story that she's told her one of her children was that she was abused by her father. But we don't know a lot about that. We know that she wasn't from the lowest economic strata of South Korea, but she grew up in fairly modest circumstances. So those are the things we kind of have gathered about her. And we also know that she's been married, three times, and then she had this relationship with Bart that stretched over 3 years, and there were some other relationships out there as well.
I mentioned before from her relationship with Bart that there's actual police reports of her being abusive towards him, right?
Yes, there are. I mean, in fact, she was found guilty of something related to domestic abuse. Which is fairly unusual for a woman when it's directed at an adult man. What do you gather from that, you know, using that psychology background of yours? Mm-hmm. I mean, what are your thoughts?
One thing we know is that people who are abused, women included, are more likely to then be abusers. It may very well be the case that she was abused in childhood. She probably had a rough upbringing. Her mother died at a young age. I mean, that alone can certainly affect people and how they relate to others. And if she had a rough relationship with her father, then that may very well be part of the cause, not all, but part of why she has gone through, you know, 3 marriages and, you know, seems to be having some difficulty relating to others in her life. I don't think that we can really blame that for her committing a murder, of course, but in terms of her attachment to others, maybe being involved in dysfunctional relationships, maybe being part of the cause of that dysfunction, I think we can probably look back at her childhood and attribute some of it to that.
You're tuned to Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern along with Scott Reeder, and we're joined by Illinois Wesleyan social psychologist Amanda Vickery, who is with us via cell phone today during Suspect Convictions. Scott, one of the things that we've received here at Suspect Convictions over the last few weeks, and some of this was a little bit because of the holidays, but we actually did receive a reach out from Masuk. You have been trying to get a hold of her during much of our time on the air here, trying to get a response from her regarding the Christina McNeil death. She did write you, so why don't you share that with our listeners at this time?
Well, here's the letter. Dear Mr. Reeder, I received your request for an interview. However, due to my own ongoing legal proceedings, I am unable to consent to any detailed media interviews at this time. With regard to Mr. McNeil's allegation of my involvement in the crime for which he was convicted, I can state with confidence that I was thoroughly investigated and excluded based on a solid alibi verified by receipts and other records. This is obviously a desperate attempt by Mr. McNeil to gain release from prison by exploiting a tragic but unrelated situation. Please let me know if you need any other question. Thank you so much for your time. Sincerely, Masuk Wang, and then in parentheses it says R89230.
Were you surprised to hear from her?
A little bit. I mean, I've written to her, I think, three times asking for an interview, wanting to give her point of view. I don't know if she's been listening to the podcast or not. Obviously, you don't have cell phones in prison, but you can have a radio, and WGLT also broadcasts this podcast, and ironically, the prison that Masuk is held in was within the coverage area of the radio station, so she could be listening to it. I don't know, but I think it's interesting that she did finally get back to us. When you listen to those words, what comes to your mind, Amanda?
She seems pretty firm in stating that she didn't do it. She's definitely pinning it on Bart, saying, you know, that this is an attempt by him to draw attention away. I guess it's not surprising that she can't really go into details about anything. Does she have appeals ongoing? Is that what she meant by her ongoing legal situation?
Yes, she has been handling her appeals on her own without legal assistance for quite a while now. And just this last month, she was assigned an attorney from the Bloomington Public Defender's Office. So she's just coming back into, you know, kind of the serious, you know, I'm going to appeal this sort of thing. The interesting thing is she's never denied killing the mother-in-law. She just... the circumstances of why she did it have been in dispute and some other things.
What did you think of her saying that she was thoroughly investigated and cleared and that she has receipts? What do you think of
good,
all that?
Well, good question, because I read this letter to Bart, and one of the first things he said is, okay, how does she know when the child was killed? What hour the child was killed at?
He said
she has an alibi, but an alibi for what time period?
Right.
He said, Christina went to bed, I think it was around 8:30. He found the body at 7. He says that he knows that he heard Christina sitting up in her bed talking about, I think it was midnight or 12:30, somewhere around there. But his question is, okay, if Masuk says she has an alibi, for what period of time does she have the alibi? Does she have an alibi for 3 in the morning? I mean, woman lived by herself.
Right, who does have an alibi for 3 in the morning?
Exactly. So... I mean, I thought that was a really good point that he was making there. It's like, okay, how can you say this if you don't have any direct knowledge of when Christina died? So I thought that was a really good point that he was making there, and I don't have a really good answer for that. I mean,
do you think the police really took Bart's claim seriously of her as a suspect at the time?
Well, obviously they didn't, because they arrested him the day of the autopsy, the day after the murder. You know, he's presenting her as an alternate suspect, but they arrest him almost immediately. Like, what have they done to verify that this woman couldn't be the killer? And that really runs through my mind. It'd be a pretty hard thing to reach a conclusion on within a matter of an hour or two after you've determined that the murder took place. Because that's right after the autopsies, they determined that a murder had taken place. Because you remember the day before, they were very dismissive of Bart when he kept calling in and saying, I think my daughter was murdered. And then the next day, they had the autopsy result come back. Yeah, we believe she was smothered. And within just a few hours, they arrest Bart because he was home, quote, alone with Christina. Now, that raises the question of how thoroughly did they investigate the alternate suspect that Bart had been pointing to? I don't know how you can say that all the alibis were checked and verified and everything was taken care of before you pick who you're going to charge with this crime. I just find that really hard to believe. I mean, what are your thoughts, Amanda?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like they had time to really investigate a whole lot. At what point do you know did he first say, hey, you need to look into my girlfriend or ex-girlfriend? Because I know Aphrodite Jones was saying, you know, why didn't he jump to this conclusion right away? Because they'd had this huge fight that night. He said, well, I didn't realize it was a murder right away. But once he called back the police and said, you know, there's a fan in here. It looks like the window's been cut. At what point did he mention Masuk?
He started mentioning Masuk right after he saw that the screens had been cut, he said.
Okay.
And he became more and more insistent as the night went on that a murder had taken place. And, you know, in fairness to Bart, I mean, I'm told that Christina did have asthma. If you found your child dead in bed, would you immediately assume it was a murder?
No, and there were no signs of anything.
I mean, there was no obvious look at the body sort of thing, like, oh, yes, this child had this. I mean, it took an autopsy to determine that a murder had taken place. I don't get too hung up on that. What the defense has said in a lot of wrongful conviction cases is what they call tunnel vision, where law enforcement focuses in on one person early on and then builds the case around them. And they arrested Bart like almost immediately after the autopsy results. And it's like they find out there was a murder and then almost immediately arrest the dad that was home with the child without really, I don't know how they could have gotten to the point where they could have ruled out the girlfriend so early on. I mean, I would think.
Or even ruled out someone else.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not unheard of for someone to break into a random house with other people home. I mean, you have the Elizabeth Smart case, the Polly Plath case. I mean, I'm sure there's many, many more. Obviously, it's rare and unusual, but there have been cases where people have broken into a home with other people present to assault someone or try to kidnap someone or whatever it may be. So even if it was not Masuk, it seems like they could have spent some time, you know, dusting for fingerprints, checking out sex offenders in the area. Maybe they did to some degree, but that could be a very real possibility as well.
Well, let me ask you this. Since you are now somebody who has been part of a case, you know, you were on the IG channel talking about the Jeff Pilo case. The Bloomington Police Department's not one without blemishes, is it?
The Jeff Pilo case was a tricky one because it definitely made the police department, of course, look bad that you have someone on the force who was actually using his connections with the police department to help him commit these crimes. He was using access to the computers and the databases to find these women, essentially. He would see them out somewhere and watch as they walked to their car, basically, and then look up their license plate to see where they lived and look up the license plates of other cars who were in their driveway to see maybe who they lived with or find out about their family. So that definitely was not a good mark for the Bloomington Police Department. But that said, my impression from everything is that once they started to suspect him, you know, they didn't try to cover it up at all. They didn't try to protect it, but they went full out and being completely open that this is the guy, this happened under our watch, and we're going to do everything we can now to put him in jail for as long as possible. So I felt like they came away from that case with still a decent reputation despite the fact that the rapist was a police officer.
We just ended our last episode on DNA and the touch DNA that was found in the case. What was your thoughts when you were listening to that episode?
I actually found it to be not that compelling because, like you said, the DNA, her DNA, Masuk, should be all over the apartment. I mean, her and Bart dated off and on for 3 years. And, you know, if you find the DNA of some random man that lives down the street, that's a little more interesting. Or if you had found maybe Masuk's blood on the sheet from where Christina had scratched her, or if you found something under Christina's fingernails. But something about the touch DNA on the sheet just didn't strike me as that compelling.
What do you personally think happened that night?
Obviously, I'm not sure. One thing I keep going back to is if Bart did it, what was his motive? So one thing that you might think at first is, well, he's a younger father. He's got this three-year-old daughter. Maybe she's a financial burden to him. Maybe he's tired of trying to, you know, arrange his dating life around taking care of her, and he wants her out of the picture. But by all accounts, I haven't seen anything that alludes to that at all. I don't think anyone testified to that. That didn't seem to be the case. So then you have maybe some sort of sexual abuse going on, which I know we have the experts going back and forth as to whether anything even occurred. If so, we don't know when, we don't know who, and so that all seems very questionable. If he was abusing her, why did he decide to kill her? Was he worried she was going to tell? Was her mom suspicious? I mean, there's really nothing pointing to any of that. And so there doesn't seem to be an obvious motive for Bart to have done it. And then one thing that you brought up a lot in one of the early episodes was the fact that Bart had essentially, if he did do it, got away with it. You know, if he did do it, he was trying to make it look like natural causes. He didn't, you know, stab her. There were no signs of distress on her body. And so the police come, and or the ambulance comes. They take her away. Everything's good to go. Why in the world would he then call later that day and say, oh, you might want to check, maybe she was murdered? I mean, that just seems stupid. He would have to have been thinking, hey, I got away with it, I'm good to go. And so if he did do it, that part just really doesn't make any sense. And so if you rule out Bart, you have maybe three other options. One, she died of natural causes. The remaining possibilities are a stranger that was just, I don't know, watching the apartment or coming by that night, which is possible but also unlikely. Or you have Masuk, who had a motive. You know, Bart had broken up with her that day. It was a very volatile relationship. And as far as we know, she has had the means. She says she has an alibi, but like you said, she couldn't have an alibi for the entire night. She knew where Christina was sleeping. She knew Bart's pattern. And so, and the biggest thing, of course, is that now we know that she's a murderer, that she has no problem killing people that she knows. In the case of her mother-in-law, it seems to be revenge to get back at her husband, which is very similar in this case, if that's what happens. You know, she killed Christina, and she did it to hurt Bart, to get revenge on Bart for breaking up with her, basically. And so when you look at all that, there's a possibility she died of natural causes. There's a possibility Bart did it. There's a possibility that a stranger did it. But knowing what we now know about her, it does seem to lean towards being more likely that she was responsible, especially given that she went on to murder someone else. I mean, there's not that many people out there who are capable or willing to murder someone. And when we know that she is, then that sort of causes you to look at everything in a whole different light.
Well, thank you, Amanda. I appreciate you taking your time for us.
Thanks to Amanda Vickery, social psychologist at Illinois Wesleyan University, a true crime buff, and part of the Independent Channel's recreation of the Bloomington, Illinois serial rapist case, for which Bloomington Police Sergeant Jeff Pilo is serving time in prison. That aired recently on the Independent Channel. She spoke to us via cell phone. Next week, Scott, during suspect convictions, we'll talk with those mainly responsible for reinterest in this case.
interestingly enough, Willis, it's two of Bart's cousins. One is Chris, who lives in California, and one is Grace, who lives in Indiana. And together, they really reinvestigated the case themselves and then reached out to the Innocence Project and got them involved. It's a fascinating story about two cousins that really didn't know Bart particularly well before incarceration, but believed in his innocence and pursued it.
That's coming up next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.
New episodes of Suspect Convictions every Friday on GLT's Sound Ideas at noon and 6. Learn more at WGLT.org/suspectconvictions.
Support for GLT comes from DoubleTree by Hilton, hosting a New Year's Eve bash with live music from Wedding Band, Absolute Light and Sound, and Kyle Yap. Package includes VIP access, appetizers, drinks, champagne toast, overnight stay, and breakfast for two. Individual tickets also available. Reservations or tickets at 309-664-6446. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We now continue a look at some of the significant stories of 2017 on GLT as gauged by readership. The Bloomington City Council approved a proposal from five community groups to establish an independent citizen-led review board to receive and oversee complaints about the police. As part of our look back this year, here is again GLT's Judy Valente talking with two Bloomington residents about their experience when they sought to file a complaint about an arrest they had witnessed.
On a warm summer evening in July 2015, Sophie Charles and Henry Dick, a couple who live in West Bloomington, watched police respond to an altercation involving teenagers in their neighborhood. Then they saw police question a man who happened to be crossing Market Street at the same time with his partner and their child. The man began gesturing, tapping his ear and his hand. Charles and Dick soon realized that both the man and his wife are deaf and that the man had been gesturing for a notepad to write responses for the police. They tried to explain to officers that their neighbor had nothing to do with the fight, but the deaf man was soon in handcuffs. Police charged him with resisting arrest. The next day, Charles and Dick went to the police department to file a complaint about the officer's conduct. They are white. Their neighbor, who was arrested, is black. They say they were dissatisfied with both the complaint process and the outcome of the police internal investigation.
We realized that it was important for us to speak up about what we had seen. And so the next morning, we went to the Bloomington Police Department to file an official complaint. And they took us into a back room. And the very first thing that they did was ask us for our first and last names, and then they left the room. And then when they came back, they asked Henry, the officer asked Henry, "Oh, are you still living at that address on Washington Street?" Which is where he grew up. He hasn't lived there in years. However, what that indicated to us was that they were looking into us. You know, that you come in to make a complaint on us, we're checking into you too. Which I think, you know, since that experience has felt like an intimidation tactic, or at least something that makes people feel that they cannot come in there and voice a complaint without feeling that they are already, their credibility is being questioned. And I do believe that this is a process that should be available to people who have no criminal record and people who do have criminal records.
Maybe they were just checking to see if you had a criminal record. Would that be such a wrong thing, Henry?
Do I think it's wrong for them to investigate people who witness a situation? Not necessarily. But will that make it so people don't file complaints? Without question. It made me hesitate, and I have no criminal background.
Go ahead, Sophie.
And we already were intimidated by the fact that we were at the police department, speaking to a police officer, a colleague of the people we now had a complaint about, and asking them to investigate their colleagues. So already, that was a very intimidating process to have to go to the police department.
So then what was the rest of the process like, filing your complaint at the police department?
Mm-hmm. So we were told that this process would be confidential, that we would give our statement, and then it would take them 30 to 60 days to investigate the complaint. So meanwhile, his criminal charges are moving forward while the police department has 30 to 60 days to decide whether there was any wrongdoing on their part. So though that was still a very real concern of ours, so we sat down with the officer and gave our statement. And I think through that process, we felt pretty very much that they were trying to placate us, that what we were sharing with the officer was not something that gave them cause for concern or alarm, but that the process was there for us to feel better that somebody was listening to it. I did not get the impression that they were taking seriously the concerns that we had about a civil rights violation on a protected population.
Was that your reaction as well, Henry?
It was. And as a result of that, we requested to talk to somebody higher up. So we ended up sitting with Assistant Chief Sutherland for about an hour. I believe he's now retired.
Gary Sutherland. Yes, he's now retired.
Mm-hmm. We sat with him for about an hour, and he was a very good listener, but it felt like he was doing his best to kind of soften the way we felt, which is fine.
Did he have an explanation as to why this incident resulted in a resisting arrest charge?
Mostly the message he was trying to communicate was that this process is a very long process, and that at best, and this is where we started to get really frustrated, at best, they would get the process done in 60 days. And that's all he was trying to communicate. We tried to draw more out of him about what their thoughts are on this, and he said, we will investigate, we will investigate, we will investigate, but it takes a long time, and we're overworked, and it's difficult to get this process done. And to me, it just seemed like they were trying to create more and more leeway for themselves. That was the priority of this conversation.
And so we asked to speak to somebody higher up, which was Chief Hefner himself. And we did sit and talk with Chief Hefner again about these same concerns. And ultimately, he came out with the same result.
We're talking with Sophie Charles and Henry Dick. They are residents of West Bloomington, and they're talking about the need for a possible citizen review board of police complaints.
71 days after we filed our complaint, we did get a letter from Assistant Chief Sutherland that our testimony was, what was the wording? Something about our claims were unfounded, our testimony was unsustained, and that ultimately the officers were exonerated.
So how did you feel then about that, Henry?
Through my experience with the complaint process, I have lost confidence that they have the capacity to review themselves, which makes me hesitant to call them if I have a problem, which makes me hesitant to call them if I witness something, because I'm worried about my neighbors who have not done anything wrong. I'm worried about the black residents walking through my neighborhood who are just trying to go about their daily lives. And through this experience, I have learned that when the police are involved, I am putting my neighbors at risk. So something needs to happen here.
Sophie Charles and Henry Dick, I want to thank you for coming in and chatting about this.
Thanks so much for having us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having us.
I'm Judy Valente.
The resisting arrest charge was eventually dropped against the deaf man from West Bloomington. The Citizen Review Board is now named and organizing.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The investigation into mismanagement at the U.S. Cellular Coliseum was another of the top GLT stories of 2017. It raises the question, why didn't the city realize what was going on? In October, GLT learned the alleged fraud scheme took advantage of a known blind spot in the city of Bloomington's oversight of arena finances, exploiting a decade-long contract that many city leaders disliked from the very beginning. Yet it wasn't just a murky contract that opened the door to the possibility of fraud. GLT found a lack of scrutiny by Bloomington leaders, even as others raised concerns about alleged food and beverage skimming that's now at the heart of the criminal investigation. Here again is GLT's Ryan Denham with the story.
I was not at all surprised. I was a little surprised and alarmed at the charges, the seriousness of the charges, and the number of charges.
That's former Alderman Judy Stearns, who served in the Bloomington City Council from 2007 to 2015.
But that things were not running, you know, the way they should was perfectly obvious to me in 2014.
Five former managers at the Coliseum, now called Grossinger Motors Arena, have pleaded not guilty to 111 counts of theft, fraud, money laundering, and other charges. They're accused of an elaborate scheme to skim off concession fees, overbill for cleaning supplies, and disguise other charges. Exact figures are not known. The charges indicate theft of around $1 million. Facing the bulk of the charges is John Butler, owner of Central Illinois Arena Management, or SIAM, which ran the Coliseum from 2006 to 2016. And he ran its in-house food and beverage company, BMI Concessions. The other four co-defendants worked for SIAM and BMI as well. The indictments capped a 16-month Illinois State Police investigation that began in 2016 after the new Coliseum managers, Venue Works, noticed alleged financial discrepancies and alerted the city. Former Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton, who served two terms from 2005 to 2013, says he was disappointed to hear about the charges, though he cautioned that the defendants are innocent until proven guilty.
You know, the Coliseum was created under the mayor before me, but during my 8 years, of which all but one or two the Coliseum was operating, my mission was to make it work, to bring entertainment to our area, and more importantly, to hopefully make a profit. We did have an operating profit for a couple of those years, but might have done better if there was an additional $1.1 million coming into the city.
Many of the criminal charges relate to BMI, the food and beverage company. Prosecutors say BMI was illegally keeping tens of thousands of dollars in commissions owed to the city as profit. The defendants were allegedly doing this using what they called the Kelly discount, an apparent reference to Kelly Klein, the Coliseum's now indicted former assistant general manager for finance. If true, a scheme like this might be difficult for the city to uncover. GLT has learned the city did not perform annual audits on BMI concessions as it did with the Coliseum itself. City officials told GLT that they had limited visibility into granular food and beverage sales figures. Former Alderman Mike Matika, a Coliseum supporter who lost his re-election bid in 2007, said he asked then-city manager Tom Hamilton during contract negotiations whether the city would have full access to Coliseum financials.
Are we going to be able to see every piece of accounting, you know, food service, sales, beverages, every piece of the economic puzzle here?
Hamilton told him yes, Matika says. But when the venue's first quarterly report was released, that granular data was not included.
And I was told, oh, that's proprietary. You're not allowed to see that. We're not allowed to see that. And I thought, well, that's a direct contradiction to the question I had asked when we signed the contract. And that just always sticks in my mind because initial concern I had just because of the controversy around the building that we really had to have total community transparency in that process.
Hamilton could not be reached for comment. The Food and Beverage Commissions were at the core of a lawsuit filed in 2014 by McLean County blogger Diane Benjamin, whose reporting alleged some of the same crimes laid out in the criminal case. In that lawsuit, Benjamin sought detailed financial records and salary information from the Coliseum. SIAM's lawyer, Bill Mueller, told the city in a January 2015 letter that SIAM should not have to release those records. He said doing so would hurt SIAM's ability to book future acts, because performers don't want the financial success or failure of a show to become public. Mueller went on to say that all concession revenue is revenue of the concessionaire, meaning BMI, and the records are property of the concessionaire. He believed it was very reasonable to, quote, conclude that the disclosure of the detailed information would be an unwarranted invasion of privacy. John Butler and then business partner Mike Nelson created BMI Concessions in October 2005, a few days after Siam's contract was approved by the Bloomington City Council. The idea of running an in-house food and beverage company, in addition to general management duties at the arena, was spearheaded by Butler, according to a former arena official who requested anonymity. That relationship between Siam and BMI concerned some city officials, although it's something that other publicly owned arenas have done. The BMO Harris Bank Center in Rockford, for example, is managed by SMG. Its food and beverage company is Savor, a subsidiary of SMG. Former Alderman Judy Stearns had concerns about that lack of transparency that might exist with such an arrangement.
There just would be no transparency. And sure enough, there wasn't.
Former Mayor Stockton says that food and beverage is, by its nature, difficult to watch closely.
You know, there were hundreds of people involved in the food and beverage operation. We had community groups out there that were actually manning the concessions to make money. There's a lot of cash flowing through there. And I guess it is a perfect opportunity for somebody to say, well, let's just take a little off the top, as is apparently being alleged. Here. So in retrospect, of course, that's 100% vision back now, but I can see where that's an easier opportunity than, for example, ticket sales, where you actually have a numbered ticket. They don't number hamburgers.
The city's 10-year management contract with Siam had a tumultuous beginning, as did the Coliseum itself. In an advisory referendum in 2005, 66% of voters said they opposed using public money for the arena, but that's what happened anyway. Those critics have maintained their opposition in the years since, with many who still wish it had never been built. Butler and Nelson, the Siam owners, were awarded that final management contract in October 2005. The Bloomington City Council initially approved a management contract with a different company, called Bloomington Partners, which included Butler and Nelson and other partners. The city eventually reneged on that contract, leading to a lawsuit. City also brought in a third company, Bloomington Normal Arena Management, led by developer Larry Hunman. Despite legal challenges, Butler and Nelson's Siam ultimately won out. Butler bought out Nelson in 2009, and Nelson exited the Coliseum management team. Nelson declined comment. City officials have had qualms with the Siam contract for years. Here's Bloomington City Manager David Hales on WJBC last week.
In the very beginning, it was not a good agreement, but once again, you got to keep in mind that, you know, this is a, even these auditors who spent weeks, if not a month each year, going over doing random testing, things of that nature, didn't identify these problems.
Records show that Hales and his finance director, Patty Lynn Silva, as well as former city manager Tom Hamilton, were all interviewed by state police during its investigation. Siam and the city parted ways in March 2016 as city leaders pushed for more financial protections in any contract renewal. VenueWorks was then hired and continues to run the Coliseum today. The original Siam contract was, quote, very, very poor and put too much risk on Bloomington and not enough on Siam, says former Alderman Skip Crawford, a local Coliseum opponent who served on the council for 10 years, from 1997 to 2007. During the October 10, 2005 meeting when it was approved, Crawford and another alderman raised questions about not having enough time to review the documents.
There was a very, very poor contract in the first place, and that is what I see coming back to bite us.
If the contract seemed to favor a private management company, one reason may be because that's who wrote it. GLT has learned an attorney for Bloomington Partners drafted that initial contract, which was reviewed by a Bloomington city attorney and two outside lawyers representing the city. The contract's 10-year term was a sticking point for city officials. Bloomington unsuccessfully sought a 5-year initial term with 2 5-year renewals, sources tell GLT. Other publicly owned arenas have opted for shorter terms. The Sears Center Arena, owned by Hoffman Estates, began with a 2-year contract with its management company, later extending by 2, 3, and 5 years. SMG is currently on a 5-year contract with the arena in Rockford, and Bloomington's new VenueWorks contract is for 5 years. In April 2014, then-Alderman Kevin Lauer and Stearns wanted the city to renegotiate its contract with Siam, using as leverage its desire to change from a professional to a junior hockey team as an anchor tenant. City administration responded by saying a council work session would be held to discuss contract issues. Stearns says that follow-up session never took place. Here's Kevin Lauer at that meeting on April April 14th, 2014.
I would really like to bring this whole issue back up and work it out once and for all. It seems like there's just an awful lot of holes that have allowed to exist over the years, okay? And I think this is a poignant point here on the operation of this entity. The people need to know what we're doing, okay? And we need to know what we're owed. And I don't think that we've defined that here. And so I'd really like to bring the whole thing up at once and get this clarified very, very soon.
Stockton says the council wasn't monitoring closely the food and beverage receipts from each event. That's more the responsibility of SIAM, or the city's finance department, or the city manager, he says.
To be quite honest, I don't think the city council was monitoring closely the food and beverage receipts from every concert. That was up to CM, it was up to the finance department, the city manager, and the auditors, more so than the city council. And I'm not sure that I or other members of the city council would have been very good judges of, well, this looks right, this looks wrong, or, boy, is there some skimming going on here?
Stern says that Hales and Mayor Terry Renner did not take her concerns seriously. Instead, aldermen were encouraged to be cheerleaders for the Coliseum, as operating losses fueled critics, Stern says. The arena posted operating losses in four of the past 5 years. Its larger-than-expected operating loss in 2016 was $670,000. It lost nearly $500,000 in 2015.
And the city took a strong position that council must be a cheerleader for the Coliseum. That it was council's role to be excited, to praise the Coliseum, and not to question. That was not considered good form, not even acceptable form to question. There were consequences, and they were serious ones.
Renner declined to comment, citing the criminal investigation. But in an interview last spring with GLT, as the city and SIAM parted ways, Renner talked transparency.
Essentially, what we're asking for are not unusual. They're standards that are typical in the industry. Now, we also made it clear that, yes, they are a private company, but if they want to do business with the city, then there are certain things that they have to agree to, and in terms of openness and transparency. And I don't think that they're trying to hide anything, but they held their cards too close to their chest, and that contract was not good for the city 10 years ago. And we have lots of contracts in the past that weren't good for the city, and moving forward, we're going to make sure that we protect our citizens.
Some may have assumed it was the job of Bloomington's external auditors, not its city manager or alderman, to stop fraud. The Coliseum was audited every year, most recently by Sikich. In 2015, the accounting firm Sikich did not find any problems with the Coliseum's financial reporting. The city's auditor gave the Coliseum a clean opinion each year, Hales has said. The city's auditors were unable to obtain all the documents necessary to complete an audit of the Coliseum in 2016 due to the state police investigation, which began around that time. In a statement to GLT last week, Sikich said it intends to continue to fully cooperate with law enforcement and the city regarding the investigation and the pursuit of justice as it relates to alleged criminal acts during periods, quote, we were retained by the city to provide audit services. In addition to the annual audits, the city also brought in specialized internal auditors, the Bronner Group, in 2015, to help review various Coliseum accounting and operational issues. Beckett, Butler's lawyer, told Pantograph, quote, the public needs to know the city is the one who hires those external auditors. My client and SIAM rely on those audits as well. The public generally misunderstands what an external auditor does for a municipality, says Ed Sipe, an instructional assistant professor in the Department of Accounting at Illinois State University. Sipe is an expert in financial reporting fraud and a certified internal auditor. That misconception has a name, the expectancy gap. An external auditor's job is usually just to confirm that a government's financial statements are reasonably accurate. They may run some tests to see if internal controls are in place, but the goal is not to find fraud, Sipe says.
It's a common thought with the public that they expect that auditors are supposed to find fraud, and that isn't the case. If they do, they will say something about it, and they will report it. But that's not what they are charged with. That's not what external auditors are charged with doing.
The most notable case of municipal fraud in Illinois happened in Dixon, where the city's treasurer stole $54 million over two decades without detection. The city of Dixon eventually sued its auditors and bank and settled for $40 million, with the auditors paying the bulk of it. That's rare, but it has happened, Sipe says. Bloomington city officials declined to say whether litigation against Sikich is being considered in the Coliseum case. Matika, the former alderman, says the allegations are very sad.
Because I think the Coliseum still has great potential to be an asset for the community, and these continual missteps in terms of management, in terms of the first manager that came from the new management group having financial issues with him too, but the depth of the accusations is actually pretty alarming when you think about the good faith effort that was made to really build a community center.
I'm Ryan Denham.
Other top stories on GLT this year included State Farm IT changes prompting employee buyouts, the doubling of overdose deaths in McLean County, and an NCHS student protest taking a knee during the national anthem at homecoming. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org.